Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
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 Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's
awesome.
Really awesome.
Awesome.
That's, so
that's awesome.
Awesome.
Oh, awesome.
That's awesome.
With Stephen Bradford. Stevie!
Yes. Yes, Bradford.
How are you, man?
Yes, Bradford. That's just music to my ears.
Is it?
No.
It isn't?
Not at all.
You don't love the sound of my voice?
No, not that pitch.
Oh.
It's like a dog whistle.
I'll bring it down a little bit.
Yeah,
bring
dude.
It down.
Give me a Barry White or something.
Dude, well, I'm not going to embarrass myself something. Because the man that we have with us today is... I was worried that our microphones wouldn't have the low end.
That's true.
To carry.
I know.
To carry
I
this
dream,
voice.
I dream of his voice.
I mean...
It's amazing.
So, well, I'm sure maybe you guys can hear, but we are very lucky to have Michael Easton join
us
today.
Yes! Wow. This is a get right here.
I mean, come on.
Because
if you're going to get got, get Michael Easton.
That's true.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That made sense, though.
You did it?
What's
did
up,
it?
Michael Easton?
Hey, man.
How are you, Steve? How are you, Bradford? Good to see you guys.
Oh, there's something about it coming through the earphones that's just getting
it.
Me.
It's getting amazing.
Me. If only I was sitting on a woofer.
Okay, calm down. Calm down.
It's,
now Michael's
it's a
leaving
family
now.
Family show there.
Michael's left the building now. Man, Michael Easton.
So you've been in, I don't know, like you've been in our lives for so long. It was part of the ABC family. Our show instantly got cooler when you joined us in 2012, 2013?
Something like that, bro. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but there's been plenty of cool things that happened to you before you came here.
Yeah. First of all, I'm going to let him tell his whole story, but he just handed us a book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, because, look, we know he's an actor and we love Michael and we love McBain, or I do at least. McBain's my favorite character. Honestly, I have like three favorite characters in daytime. And Michael thought I was busting his chops one day.
No, dude, I can attest to this.
He can't because he's on the road with me. And I'm like, dude, McBain is the freaking man and we need to get McBain back. But Michael came in, and the interesting thing is, you've written how many books, Michael?
I think I've written three graphic novels and then this poetry book, yeah.
Yeah, so this is called 18 Straight Whiskeys. Mm. This is a poetry book.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a biography about me. 18 Straight Whiskeys.
Yeah. Last night?
Yes, exactly. No. But
so when did this come out?
That came out at the end of last year, November of 2018, and
awesome.
Been promoting it, and... part of the book was written in 1994. My mom passed away in 1994, and this is going to sound very... I went to Paris and lived there for a few months and just started writing, trying to get my thoughts in order. And then I was doing a show in Vancouver called Two for Stephen Candle, and when I was up there again, I was trying to sort of a cathartic moment, do some reading, started to share my thoughts because I'd been very private about it.
Yeah.
So I started sharing my thoughts with people, and I just started doing some readings there, and a publisher came and said, hey, you should think about publishing that book. So I kind of took all the things that were kind of kept in a Nike shoebox, and I started writing them down, and they were kind enough to publish it in 1994. Actually, the second publishing came out in 1998, and then they approached me last year for the 20th anniversary.
Wow.
And they said, would you like to write some more poems? And I hadn't looked at the book in 20 years. And I went back and looked at it, and I go, well, can I change all the old poems? and they go, no, that's actually the story. This is who you were in 94, or 94, 98, and now this is 20 years later. And it's evolved. And so I wrote new poems, and you can kind of see the difference between, you know, the young punk and the older punk.
Right.
You know,
and
so it's it was a really good experience. But they wouldn't let me change one thing of the earlier poems. So... but it's, you know, now it's different, you know.
Yeah.
Earlier it was about, you know, the quote comes from Dylan Thomas, who that was his last words. He said, I just had 18 straight whiskeys. He was drinking at the White Horse Tavern. And he came home to his girlfriend and said, I think that's the record. And he fell over dead.
Really?
And, I was thought that always stuck with me. And I don't know why. Weird things stick with me. But now it's different. I mean, in 2011, in the course of, I started writing again because in the course of... a couple months, you know, I lost my father and I became a father for the first time. And so you have all these thoughts about you know, you know, you want to A, apologize to your dad, which you never got a chance to properly do, because you don't realize that until you become a father. Like, what a
complete jerk
you might have been.
Or how much, because I, you know, I lost my dad, and it's, and he was young, you know, and it's, it, you don't realize. I don't know, it's so, it sounds so cliche that you don't realize till somebody's gone, but it's like, you know, it's just, it's such a strange thing to lose a parent, but my father, and then become, and being a father, it's just a weird dynamic, man. It's really strange.
And you probably know, there's so many days you'd like to be able to call him up and, and also go, hey, Dad, how did you do this? You know, and I don't have my mom or my dad to do that with, so it's a, I'm really out there with my wife, you know, and she looks after me, but but that's, so there's a lot of that stuff in the books. So it's a lot of fun, but I certainly don't want to turn your show into poetry.
I just think it's so fascinating. Like when you came back to the book and you're looking at it, well, I mean, what struck you more, the differences or the similarities? Or I mean, you know, in my own journey as a husband, as a father, and then just thinking about 10 years and thinking about how I feel, almost felt unconscious in my mid-20s, and just lack of presence. And I mean, you were going through something so severe there. Like, I'm just curious, what was the most striking thing about revisiting the headspace of a 20 year ago person that was you?
Yeah, there was, I mean, there's certainly moments of just realizing, wow, I'm lucky I made it. It was a pretty self-destructive time. I was doing a lot of things that were, I was punishing myself or penance or something.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to recognize some of those aspects of that, because obviously now I live for my children in many ways, you know, and I try to set a better example. And,
right.
But I did write, in case they ever read this, I tried to make up for it, because I wrote a poem for my son and I wrote a poem for my daughter.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
And so maybe they'll see that, you know, Dad wasn't all this. he had two sides.
Yeah.
So, and he put one behind him.
So you're from California, right?
Originally. I mean, my mom and dad are both from Belfast, Northern Ireland. And they came over and we lived some time in New York. And then we came here, and then we went back and lived in Ireland for 2 years. But I got kind of dug into California around high school time. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So were your parents in the arts at all?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
My dad was an engineer.
Wow.
And probably was wise to put me off ever getting into the arts. He was the guy that said, all those people are sons of actors and daughters, and you know, you're not going to make it into that thing. And he meant well, you know.
Sure.
He meant
he was looking
best.
Out for you.
Very much. Right. You know, it's good advice. I mean, in many ways, it is a difficult industry, but he just was so, they knew I couldn't have been farther away from it.
Right. So when you were in, what do you remember from those years abroad? What kind of kid were you? What were you into?
Yeah, I was a really quiet kid. I mean, I lived in my head a lot, which explains, you know, the writing of the graphic novels and the books and stuff like that. I used to draw and write, and I was always doing stories, and I was a very awkward kid growing up.
You showed them now, right?
Yeah. You know, my high school guidance counselor once said I would never amount to much, and I've always meant to call her up, and then I realized she's probably right.
You heard of McBain, bitch? Yeah.
She's probably right, but it's been a good life.
That's funny, man.
So when did you feel the pull? Like, when did the beginnings of ending up where you ended up start to grab you?
Yeah. I think I always had the pull towards there, but I think I wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And we did a play in New York when I was living there, when I was 19, I think, and 20, and put it up. And
you say we.
I was working with a group there. Got a couple guys on the outside of the theater company, and this girl was really bright and couldn't afford to pay any actors, so we did. I wrote the play, and we ended up – it was the first time I ever performed. And one night, some development person from NBC came, and everybody was pretty excited about this. Yeah. And she came backstage, and I said, "Hey, what'd you think of the play?" And she goes, "That might have been one of the worst plays I've ever seen." But she goes, "You're not a bad actor." And I, you know, I had written it, so I took that pretty hard. But you know, she said, gave me her car and said she'd come see me sometime, and that's. I took a couple of weeks after the insult wore off.
Right.
And,
yeah. And then once you could see the light of day again, walk out your house without crying.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah, am I bleeding here? Thank you. But it was good. I took a couple weeks and realized, okay, this doesn't sound too bad. And I did a couple plays, and then the first thing I did was I did one film, and then the first thing I did sort of note was Days, right?
Yeah, so, okay, sure.
And it was one of those things. I was living in New York, and I flew out and.
So once you got hooked up with that lady, she got you representation. She got you.
She sent me out to a few people and started getting me some scripts and introduced me some agents of this and kind of got me started put me in the right direction. Showed me the way to get to class and I think sort of making sure that you had things figured out. And then they sort of set me out and one of those days where it was pre cell phone days is how long this goes. But I remember I flew out and I tested and then I flew back. And by the time I got back there on my answer machine in New York,
time to fly back?
Yeah, yeah, you need to go. And I lived at there used to be a place over there by Burbank Studios called the Holiday Motor Lodge or something like this. And I lived in that motor lodge for like 4 months because I was pretty sure they were going to catch on and fire me.
Right. So you weren't looking for anything permanent.
No, I was paying. I started off paying by the night, and by the end of it, I was paying by the week.
Right.
And I kept saying, you got to get an apartment. I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be there that long.
What is this good looking dude renting hotel rooms by the night? What is his deal?
That's funny.
Yeah. You're either on Days or you're a gigolo.
It was a really popular place for people that were having surgery at St. Joseph's. They would stay there. So a lot of times in the morning, I'd come out, and this is, again, pre-Uber days. There'd be people standing there going, can you give me a lift over for my appendectomy? And I'd be like, all right, I'm going that way.
Sure, yeah.
Help people in your car, and you'd drive over. It was a rental. You'd drive over and drop them off at St. Joseph's.
Those were the days, buddy.
Yeah. Hope they all make it.
Ambulatory service. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so – and
well, this acting thing didn't work out. I figured I needed to have something up my sleeve.
Make a few contacts. How long do you end up doing Days?
Not long. I got fired after about maybe it was a year and a half, a year. They caught on to me or something like that.
Shut up.
They fired. I was fired. But I can't remember all the circumstances. My memory, and this is true, I've gotten, as I've gotten older, things kind of blur. And I don't remember the exact circumstance of it, but I do remember. I was supposed to be there for longer than what I was.
Do you remember what it was like to work there? Do you remember feeling like, I don't have this? Or did you feel confident and it just circumstances conspired against you? Or do you remember how you felt being over there?
Pretty overwhelmed. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I'd done one film and I'd done stage. And that skill set doesn't exactly apply. It's a whole different skill set.
Totally, yeah.
And, I didn't know what I was doing. And I was probably a real pain in the ass, too.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I'd done a few things where you had...
You've done something with meat on it. What is this nonsense?
Yeah. What is this?
And look, I wasn't looking for... at the time, I was pretty difficult. I wasn't looking for a long-term thing. It wasn't like I wanted to be there for...
Right.
Didn't know what I was doing. I was that guy in the first part of the book. You know?
Yeah.
I was still trying to figure myself out a little bit.
And who's this weirdo with a patch?
Yeah. Yeah. Steve is really kind. It was a really kind group, though. I really liked everybody over there. They were really and they were very patient and very kind with me. And I always I do have fond memories of being there. I just can't.
Early 90s?
Yeah.
Early 90s, right?
Maybe 90, 91, 91, 92, okay. Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
By 92, I was gone. And then that's actually when my mom got real sick in 93. And I went home and I stayed with her for about a year.
Back to New York?
No, my mom was – they were living in San Clemente at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, and I spent about a year there, and I was just – she would go to these long chemo sessions.
Yeah.
And this is kind of just a brief story about how funny life can be sometimes, but I'd go and it'd be 5 or 6 hours she'd have to be there. And my mom was a big reader. She loved – but just reading like Book of the Month Club types, that was her deal. And she read all these books of Bridges of Madison County and whatever came in.
Yeah.
And one of the books I was reading to her – while she was going to, when she passed away, also, I wasn't literally reading it to her when she was passed away, but we were in the middle of it when she got really sick and we stopped reading. Was a book called Coco by an author named Peter Straub. Peter's written a couple books, some great books on his own. And he also wrote a couple great books with Stephen King, The Talisman and Black House.
Okay.
And interesting enough, I finished the book. It took me a while to get back to it, but I finished the book. Jump cut to 18 years later. I'm working in New York at One Life to Live. Yeah. And I'm walking down towards my dressing room. We lived in the basement. It's not like luxury like you guys here with sunlight and windows. You know? We shared dressing
just
rooms.
Just a lab of
luxury.
Yeah,
I remember
sure,
you guys. Yeah. That was, I couldn't believe, because I went over and with Kimberly McCullough. We did,
oh, yeah.
We
yeah.
did like a couple days on your stage, and the freaking dressing rooms were half this size.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And two people were in it.
That was the place in the mid-60s on the west side, somewhere in there?
All my children was down by the waterfront. They had the lovely waterfront.
Right.
We are at 66 in Columbus.
Right, yeah.
In old armory.
Yeah.
And it hadn't changed much. And I shared a dressing room with Kamar De Los Reyes, you know. Yeah. So we were crammed in this little room, and, you know, I'm sure.
Well, he's got muscles, so he takes up more space.
He took up a huge amount of space.
Yeah.
When he flexed,
it was a contracting room.
Yeah, man, it was tough.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys looked at it like, how can these animals live like this? But, we'd crawl out of our hole and go up to the stage once in a while. And I remember I was walking through the studio one day, and the book my mom and I had been reading was Coco, and I walk up to the stage, and I pass this kind of big man and his daughter walking down the hallway, and went up to the stage. I did my work, and we had these little cubby boxes. It wasn't like here where they used to deliver your scripts.
You had to fetch them yourselves?
We had to fetch them ourselves,
oh,
right?
Oh, my gosh.
And I go down, I go to get my script, and there's a paperback book in there, and I pull it out, and it's Coco, and it's to Michael from Peter Straub. And the big man who passed me in the hallway was Peter Straub, and he was there with his daughter, and they were doing a tour for his birthday, because he was a fan of the show. And Michael Malone, who was our head writer at the time, was a mystery writer, and they'd all kind of gotten together. And he left me this book. So here it was 18 years later. The man who wrote the book that I was reading to my mom leaves me a copy of the book. And it just turns out he liked the cops on the show. He liked Bob Woods.
Yeah, yeah.
And he liked Hillary Smith.
He knew
none of this story, bro.
Oh, wow.
None of this. And I don't know if I explained it properly to that extent. But anyways, here's this copy of Coco.
Yeah.
It took me a couple months to connect with him because it was too overwhelmed by the story.
Yeah.
But I ultimately called him. He said, hey, we should meet. We had a drink and we talked and became friends. And we ended up writing a book together, which is The Green Woman. We wrote this graphic novel together.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of a roundabout story about how strange this life is and some of the things you remember and some of that. But it's been a strange journey.
Well, and the fact that you guys created something together and that lives on, there's something so beautiful about the beginnings of that relationship before it was a relationship, right? And then, God, it's like planting a tree. It's like planting a tree. I don't know. There's something that...
Well, it's already depth there.
Yeah.
You know, to the relationship, which is cool.
And I actually got in reverse. I got... Peter, although he'd written 30 million books and done all these things, said, I'd love to be on One Life to Live sometime. and I heard this, and I was like, And then, but my wife heard this, and she goes, oh, yeah, Michael can get you on there. And I'm like, you know, your wife, too.
Right.
And I looked at her like, how do you know I can get him on there? What are you talking about? It's not a...
Right.
But I went and spoke to Frank, and he said, oh, I love Peter Straub. Let's get him something. And so we ended up playing this blind ex-detective of my father. He was a detective and had been partners with my father, and there was a little murder mystery where Bane went back to follow it, and he pled this blind guy in the pier, and that was Peter Straub. He was on for 4 or 5 episodes. It was really
cool.
And they gave him something interesting, too. He just wasn't like a reporter.
Like a dead body.
No, he was like, you know, he did acting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
He was really good, too. Yeah,
yeah, that's so cool, dude.
Now, when you were done with Days, were you just eager to jump right back into... What did you want to do next, I guess?
No, I took a little break after Days.
I took about a year
and stuff, and I eased my way back in.
Yeah.
You know, I had kind people that were representing me at the time, and they said, take whatever time you needed. And I came back about a year later, and they sent me out, and I was really lucky. I went and I did a wonderful series called VR5, which I really loved at Fox.
I remember
that.
It
had a great cast. It had Laurie Singer and Will Patton and Louise Fletcher and Dave McCallum, and it was executive produced by John Sackert Young, who did China Beach. He just won a bunch of Emmys for China Beach. It was a really great series, but one of those things that just didn't last.
Sure.
I've done a lot of things that didn't last. I used to walk into castings at pilot season, you know, and I go, here's the good news and the bad news. Every pilot I've done has been picked up for one season.
Right.
Bad news is everyone's been canceled after one season. Right. None of them ever made it longer than one season.
Well, I got to say, there's got to be a lot of people that are just would be grateful enough just to get it on
absolutely.
Air.
Right? No, absolutely.
So that's a decent track record is all I'm saying, right?
It wasn't bad.
Yeah.
I was really lucky. I got to work on some great stuff. Probably the most rewarding show I got to do, I did a show called 413 Hope Street, which was also on the Fox network. And Damon Wayans was the executive producer of it, and it sort of told his story about growing up in New York, and Richard Roundtree was in it, and Jesse Martin. Amazing cast, and I really felt really close. And again, it got canceled very quickly, but it had a fantastic cast, and I really felt really close to everybody I got to work with there. And
yeah. Was that Jesse Martin after Rent?
That was Jesse after Rent,
yeah.
Pre-Law
and Order.
Pre-Law and Order, and then Jesse and I both went over to Ally McBeal. That's how I think got us both over. I went over, I think, first, and Jesse came over second. And,
okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic actor, and he deserves everything he's getting, and obviously he's just never stopped working.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you did – that's quite a string of good work in that time, like being on a show like Ally McBeal, and then you were in that world of Ally McBeal – right, because
did the practice.
Yeah,
I got David was. I mean, he's such a wonderful writer, and he's one of those guys that you just trust everything he puts out there. So really lucky to get to work for David Kelly, and I mean, I got to work with some great. I mean, I think I did the first show that Showtime ever did called Total Recall 2070, and that.
Oh wow, was that was their first
that was
foray?
Showtime.
That was their first foray into original programming.
I believe so. Yeah, maybe the first or second. It was, you know, that was an amazing experience, and
yeah.
How many episodes of that did you do?
One season, bro.
So what's
2022, I think.
Yeah, oh, that's a good run. 22 is a good run.
That was good, no, man. Yeah. It was really wonderful. It was sort of more Blade Runner than it was Total Recall, but it was a really great show. It's been a fun career. Nothing's lasted, but it's been a really fun career.
You say that, and then all of a sudden you spend the next 18 years of your life playing one character.
Five characters.
Five characters. But
seven,
I mean,
characters.
All being birthed out of one character, really, right? Mm. Like, I know you've played multiple characters on our show, but if we had had our way, you wouldn't have been, probably.
No, probably. If it wasn't for the legal thing, I'd probably still make McBain unless
they
wouldn't have put a knife in McBain's back, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. No. I don't know if you were putting that out in the universe, if you were putting longevity out in the universe, but boy, did it come. When that opportunity to go to One Life came up, was that something that you jumped at, or were you like, hey, I remember doing Days, I'm doing this other stuff now, or was it Welcome?
Yeah, no, it was really, I mean, we had...
Where were you at this point in your life?
Port Charles.
First, that's right.
Port Charles was first. We were doing Total Recall, and they were in hiatus, and Mark called up and said, and I'd known Mark for years. We used to ride motorcycles. I forget. I used to see him at the Mark Teschner's our casting director, wonderful guy, and I mean, genuinely cares about actors and really still goes to showcases and plays and still pulls all this wonderful talent that we get to work with every day. I don't think anybody works harder, and he also sees a lot of new actors, and I think that's a really cool thing because it's hard for some of these young actors to go get seen.
Yeah,
and I know he's still the guy always looking for new talent. I think that's a really cool thing that he does and supports the acting community like that way. But Mark had said, "Hey, you want to come down and do 10 weeks?" And it was either during the strike or I was on hiatus from that, and I said, "Well, 10 weeks, I can do that standing on my head, you know."
Right. Sure. Yeah.
And he goes, "The only thing is, we can't tell you what the part is."
No.
So it's like, huh. He's like, top secret. I'm like, soap opera. It's a doctor, a lawyer, a cop. What else is there?
Uh-oh.
I go in there and they go, okay, so it's a vampire priest. And I'm like, two characters? And they're like, yeah, it's actually going to be two characters for the first, and then we're going to find out it's one character.
So you're only getting paid for one.
But it amazed me that they were going to try to do that. I thought it was really ambitious.
Yeah.
And, it was great.
Looking back, it was way ahead of its time.
Yeah, I think
that show was ahead of its time. There's no way. There's no. I mean, with True Blood and all the other stuff that came years later, that thing was ahead of its time, man.
I think Twilight came out like 6 months later, and I think it probably would have been.
Oh, did it 6 months later?
Yeah, like after Port Charles, something like
this. The books or the movies?
I think the books
came out, and I think, you know, it would have got. But it was.
I thought they were ahead of their time, but you know. Looking back,
it was a great energy, that show, with such a great cast, and had so much fun working with them. But I remember, I think it was the first time that they had been nominated for a bunch of Emmys, and they were kind enough to fly us out. We went back to New York, and I remember sitting next to Torsten, and I think they were up for Best Show that year, and Torsten was like, "Well, if we win Best Show, they can't cancel us." And they announced whoever the winner was, and it was not us. And he turned, he goes, "We're canceled."
Was it pretty evident?
Two days later, we got the call. Then we came back, and then, you know, the show had been on maybe 4 or 5 years
I think it did 5 years.
5 years?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know
it
was that.
But it never got a fair shake because they kept – it never aired at the same time. It wasn't a lead-in for GH. It was on some weird
–
some markets was on like 11 a.m. or it was just hard in every city. Like, where is it? You can't even find it.
Right.
You know, but so I'm assuming that led into One Life.
Yeah, and then they said we'd like to just – and then that became – just hit it a really good time. You know, I had, you know, sometimes in your life you're looking for a change, right? And I think
you were going back to New York, right?
Get to go back to New York, right? I'd been out here at that point for like 10 years and we are, you know, you move farther up into the hills and you get away from people and it's cool and all, you're up with the coyotes and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah.
But I go, you know, it's going to be, I want to get back on the street. I want to, you know, be on the subway and see people and talk to people and be engaged again. And I didn't plan on doing that. I think it was a 1 year deal originally because I wasn't sure that, and it ended up being 9 years maybe.
Something, especially if you grow up on the East Coast or spend time in Europe as you did, like you can get comfortable in LA, but man, there is life as a human being in this city is unlike any other place, and not necessarily for the better, you know?
Right.
In terms of your interactions with other humans.
Where? Here?
Yeah.
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 That's one thing I kind of would have loved is to spend some time in New York on a show there for a couple years, just to experience that. Because everybody who talks about it, it was an amazing part of their life.
Yeah.
You know, there's something special about that time in New York. And, you know, I hear all these stories and I'm like, because I'd go for the Emmys and hang out and see you guys and do all that. But nothing's like living there. That energy of living there, it has to be incredible. You know?
Yeah. And every night you walk out of the studio and you're walking out with 7 or 8 people, you've just put in this ridiculously 12, 14 hour day. And you know, and
then I'd be in jail.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's 4 bars between here and the subway.
Then I'd really be dead.
Hey, let's just have one.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Next thing you know, let's go back and sleep in the dressing room. We got to work in 2 hours, you know?
Right,
man.
So it was good fun.
That was pretty much the whole 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and 2000. And 2000s.
But there is something like, you know, when you're there for the Emmys, you probably have someone that's checking up on you and making sure you're getting to where you need to go and whatnot.
Sure.
Once you find a way to exist there, not just get from place to place, but really be, like, comfortable there and like, oh, I know who I am amidst all this, and I feel good about that. There's a confidence. There's an independence. It builds character, but it also builds compassion. There is something about living there that, as a human being, it's an experience that is incredibly worthwhile.
Yeah, it's well said.
We were doing an East Coast tour last year, and we got him on the commuter train between Philadelphia and New York, and he was like a little boy. We talked about this with Kristen Alderson, actually, and it just occurred, and it was funny for both Kristen and myself, that he had never been on, like, a train.
Well, that was probably my first time at a train station.
Yeah.
For more than 5 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, like, I was like, wow, this is amazing. I have my little carry-on.
Yeah.
And we go and we get a coffee.
Right.
You know, and then we take that train, and then, which was cool because, you know, the seats were humongous. It was like first class. But it wasn't.
No,
but
it
felt like, you know, it was great.
It was, and there was a,
you know,
there's
a drink train or whatever the hell they call it.
Cafe car.
and then the worst part was, though, he goes, we started going underground. He goes, okay, this is the last time we'll be above ground.
Until
we were in Astoria.
Cause
and I'm like, what are you talking about? He's, we're going to be underground the whole way. And I kind of got a little nervous, like a little anxious,
right?
Because I don't have claustrophobia, but I've had my moments.
Sure.
I wanted to jump out of the train a little bit.
Well, you've had more recent years talking about how you should be claustrophobic for years, so
pretty much. So it was but man, you get off that dude, if you can survive in New York City, dude, you can survive anywhere.
It's a tough city, but it's also an incredibly compassionate city. It's a side you don't get. I never saw so many people help other people, too. I never saw so many people literally pick other people up that had fallen and help them cross the street. It's kind of it's the best of all things in many ways, you know?
Happy to be talking about one of our favorite sponsors, FabFitFun.
FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. And who better to talk about it than the recipient of the FabFitFun boxes in our family, my wife, Kira.
Bradford, I'm very excited to tell your listeners about the FabFitFun box, which I first received from one of my favorite students. And she's my favorite student now because she got me a FabFitFun box. What I love about FabFitFun is the excitement of opening it and seeing what I get. It's customizable, which is super fun. Some of my favorite brands come in this box, like Tarte. I use that makeup brand pretty much every day. Some really special products from Anthropologie. I got some really nice lotion one time that I'm out of now, but I'm going to go buy it again because I loved it so much. It's pretty exciting. I think if you're looking for a gift for a special woman in your life, it's a beautiful thing to gift to another special lady or gift to yourself, because we women work hard and we deserve a little treat.
You deserve all the things. What's cool about FabFitFun is each box has a value over $200, but it retails for only $49.99. Even better, listeners of That's Awesome can use coupon code AWESOME10 for $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. So, for a box worth over $200, you're only paying $39.99 for your first box. Pretty cool.
So cool.
So use coupon code AWESOME10 for $10 off your first box at
FabFitFun.com.
You guys did some really cool stuff over there. The musical stuff you did, I'm not sure if you were involved with, like, you know, Mary J. Blige and Snoop Dogg coming up. I'm not sure. Did McBain rap with Snoop Dogg? I'm not sure he did, but...
Snoop Dogg was Bo Buchanan's informant, or sort of he assisted Bo, and he...
Oh, okay.
He...
That's amazing.
He and Bob Woods, and so
that's their own TV show. They should have a spinoff.
I couldn't agree more. And really, that really what we
Bob
should have
Woods
done.
It's Snoop Dogg. That's amazing.
And he was so cool, and he was a fan and of the show, and that was a big part of his family's life. And I think at one point he turned to the camera and he goes, "Hey, look, Mom, I'm on One Life to Live. I made it." You know,
that's awesome.
Woods and I both.
Unironically, right?
No, totally. Yeah, totally serious. So he was really, that was a big part. The stories were a big part of his upbringing. And so he was so kind to come and sort of lend us his presence, because he's just one of those guys that walks in the room and brings that presence. And yeah, we did have some amazing guest stars. We used to have athletes dropping by all the time and stuff like that. And it's always weird when you get these guys, you kind of, and my ball players and stuff as they come by. And it's just them, I think, you know, because they have so much downtime during the day.
Yeah, they watch sometimes in the clubhouse. It's on too.
Yeah, they're looking for, I think some, as they would say to me, some they travel. And so they're looking for some continuity in their lives. And all right, so I know if I turn on, you know, whatever it used to be, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whatever. I know my stories are going to be on. So it felt, you know, there's a comfortability in that. And that's, I guess, something to what we do, right? People get to know you, you know.
In L.A., when you're on a soap, it's a different, entirely different totem pole. It's not even up or down. It's an entirely different one. But in New York, for New York actors that are just focused on doing good work and paying their rent, a soap is a great job because you work during the day. So if you're doing a play, you can still do it at night.
Absolutely.
Most of the time. And so what I always loved about meeting you guys and, you know, the One Life and the All My Children people is that you guys kind of merged the worlds that I was familiar with. I was familiar with the soap, but the New York life that I lived before, being part of the creative community in New York City instead of being in a corner of it out here. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I think you did. And we had these brilliant theater actors come in and out of the production playing small parts. These guys were like, you know, I was Obie Award winner and stuff of this. And I'm the U5 bartender this week because it's just, hey, I'm picking up a check because this is what I'm. But I mean, probably the best example of that is, you know, for 2 years, John McBain was involved with Evangeline Williamson, who was played by Renee Elise Goldsberry.
Oh, yeah.
Who, of course, went on to win a Tony Award for
Hamilton. So she was doing a Broadway show.
She was not doing Hamilton at the time, but she had done Color Purple, and she'd done Shakespeare in the Park, and Renee was always floating between those two worlds. And just, I mean, it was such an amazing, brilliantly talented group. We also had Tika Sumpner on our show.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
They played sisters. I mean, they were on our show, exploding with talent. And I think we were all aware, but I just don't know if the writing worked out properly. but they were brilliant, and we were so aware of how brilliant they were. And,
Tika's doing amazing stuff right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fun, and of course Renee is as well. It's like it's fun to. You always see people, and there's so many people that come through the daytime world. You're inevitably going to see many people do great things, but it's really fun, right?
Yeah, but Renee was probably she did I don't know if it was As You Like It or Taming the Shrew they did that year in Shakespeare in the Park, and she had an entrance. It was like nobody's entrance in the history of theater. And, you know, we'd worked all day, and we all went over that night, and she was just brilliant. And that was...
Dude, that's a beast.
Yeah, she's
that's
amazing.
That's a beast right there.
She's amazing.
To be able to do a Broadway show or a show and daytime at the same time, that's amazing.
Yeah,
dude.
Well, and that's the
just like working. I mean, to do 30 pages a day or whatever, and then go do a show, and then go to bed. What time of shows end? Usually midnight.
Oh, in New York,
10:30,
11.
So then you got to go home, memorize 30 pages, get up and do it again. That's a talent, man.
Yeah, work hard.
Yeah, most theater actors aren't getting up at 6 to make a 7 a.m. call either. So that's tough.
Did you guys, when you, for the people who listen, call times, did you guys block and tape back then? Or did you kind of come to the studio, because before we'd have 3 o'clock calls. If we were at the end of the day, we wouldn't have to come in for blocking. We would actually just block the scene before the scene, rehearse it, and tape it. Did you guys ever do that, or did you guys always kind of block? Blocking for the people listening is getting your movement down with your dialogue the director gives so he can, shoot the show. But
we did blocking in the morning, but I think they were on such a budget that we actually blocked in the rehearsal space downstairs in the basement. We couldn't get on the studio floor.
Did you guys have taped out?
Because they would have meant with a union thing. They would have to. So we would literally. So they'd be. You'd come in and it was like pantomiming when you were a kid.
Yeah,
so there's cardboard boxes. Your house.
We sometimes do it in this one.
We do once in a while.
Yeah,
most of the time we're on the set.
What most of the time?
That's why we used to look at you guys. Go look at those. Look at those
spoiled
brats.
Bastards
rehearsing on the studio floor. I'm over here. The water cooler is playing.
That's your office.
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny, man.
And do you remember, were you there the day that you guys got the bad news over there? Like, what was that like?
We got I wasn't there because the day we got the bad news, my daughter was born. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Crazy day.
I was over at Lennox Hospital. Yeah, I mean, I won't wake you up. You know, hey, just have a chat.
And sorry,
Melissa,
you don't have a job,
Melissa called me and said, hey, we were just called into a space, and by closed circuit TV, Brian Franz said that they were canceling All My Children and One Life to Live. I was like, okay, well.
Oh, gosh, man.
Melissa Fumero?
No.
Melissa Archer?
Melissa Archer.
Archer.
Melissa had already left. Speaking of someone else who's doing doing terrific.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, it was a little bit of a. I remember it's April 15th. That's what I know.
Yeah, and your damn taxes are due. What a shitty day.
Yeah.
But your daughter was born, yeah.
Yeah, that was. It's a good day for me, but not so much for everybody else. Yeah, it was. Live without a net, right? I mean, you're back on the circus, right?
Wow.
Yeah, so then was it... I mean, obviously there were talks of immediately about extending it and making... Right? Like, there were... Did you immediately go, all right, that's done? What's next? Or what was that like?
Yeah, I think we caught COVID. And then, of course, there was this other group.
The Prospect Park
group. Guys, yeah. And they were going to keep it going. And, I mean, we had... the thing about New York, you walk out of the studio and there's... The fans are there, and they were heartbroken. We literally went out that day, and as you get to know them, and we went out and people were crying, they were really upset. So when someone came along and said, hey, we're going to continue this, and we're going to keep it going, I think most of us, you feel some allegiance to it. And, so as quickly as we said, okay, well, then they kind of pulled us back in for a while, and the fact that they just didn't quite pull it together.
Right.
I'm not sure what happened with that. I was kind of distanced from that, but it didn't quite pull together, but it was, I feel bad because it didn't, I don't think we really, I think when you have a finality, like we had the same thing with Port Charles, I'm starting to be on a lot of shows that have been,
it's the nature of the beast. It's not you.
You like to actually know that you're wrapping them up, right?
So sure.
Port Charles, we got canceled while we were on our hiatus, so we never really wrapped it up. Those always open,
Sucks.
And
no closure.
Same with One Life to Live. They didn't want to wrap it up because they thought, hey, at this moment, they thought they were going on.
Right.
Yeah, that sucks too.
So we didn't finish that up. So you always kind of feel like it's you'd love to have that closure, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like McBain just walking out of here. For me personally, I know no one else probably, but for me to walk out of there after playing the part for like, you know, the only thing that was kind of interesting to me, I don't know if I told anybody else, is I wore the same pair of shoes as McBain for like 9 years. So I always thought McBain was the kind of guy that just had one pair of shoes and he would just keep resoling them.
Yeah.
So I had the one pair of shoes and it was like, that was the last time I'd wear those shoes, you know? And
wow.
I think it's the only thing I took.
Yeah.
Out of, in New York.
It was, but here, actually walking out of here, knowing, here. Oh, by the way, that's the last time you'll play McBain. I actually actually with Finola, my last scene.
Right.
I just kind of would walk out the door and you're like, it's probably not the closure. You know, if you play someone for 9, 10 years, you would want something a little more.
Sure.
But you retired the shoes?
You know, sometimes I feel like I go dancing, I throw them back. You
know? When that was done, and obviously you're a new dad, so you have plenty to think about. But I mean, what was going in your brain? Like, what did you think was going to be next?
Right. Well, you know those. You know, when you first have that, you know, newborn, right?
Yeah.
And you're just trying to make it through a night with it, get an hour's sleep. So
totally,
the
yeah,
last thing in your mind is a job. You know,
right,
except
sure.
for you do have to obviously keep a roof and keep things in the fridge and stuff like that. But it was. Yeah, you know, I just remember wanting to be there with her a lot, and so I didn't really think about it. And it's always been when I wasn't acting, I always tried to approach it as, rather than getting crazy about it, I got to get another job, and I got to get a dish, I got an agent. I try to be a little more just being, you know, and just let it be. And you don't want to, you can only push so much.
Right.
And so I always go back and, hey, this is time to write. And I always try to take that and let's go write something and let's go. Right, so because I do believe, you know, if there's any actors out there, the best part you'll ever get is the part you write for yourself. I mean, I haven't done that. But that would be my two bits on that, you know.
Yeah.
So I always go back to write. I don't write for myself, I write. But I still go back to that original joy of the guy that wrote the play.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. But I'm still trying to build that.
It's a process.
It's a process.
So the writing was really before acting.
Yeah, very much.
So you always can go back to that. I mean, that's kind of your creative outlet, so to speak, if you know, because we talk about it a lot, just, you know, sometimes here you kind of lose that creative feeling sometimes because you're doing something day in, day out, it's going fast, you don't really have time to figure it out, you know, you live for those scenes where you can connect, you know, but sometimes it's just, you're just doing the scene, you know, and there's not another creative outlet for people who are just waiting for the phone to ring or trying to get out to do another show or something. You know, we've always been kind of talking about, you got to kind of create your own, you know, your own projects.
Absolutely.
Whether it's short films, because I know you've directed, which I've seen a lot of shorts that you've directed and you're fantastic.
Thank you.
That's just, so it's just interesting. I love that you're a writer. I love that that's the outlet for you, because you're good at it, obviously, and it's just so cool that you can just compartmentalize, kind of like, hey, okay, I'm just going to write, you know, and to be able to write the stuff that you love to write, which is cool, you know. So
thank you.
It's just interesting, man. It's always been intriguing. He's always been a man of mystery.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's the coolest thing, Michael, because, you know, you're a very gracious guy. You're a very humble guy. You love what you do. You love being here. You're just such a good person. It's, you know, I know a lot of people, because you're not on social media, you're not out there a lot. So, I mean, obviously we appreciate you sitting down with us, but it's just cool to be able to share you and insight that you have with people, you know, because there's so much chaos out there in the world. And I think you have such a great perspective on just life from the conversations we've talked about, and just, you know, art and just becoming better, you know, in life and helping people out. And it's just cool to see that you do that.
Thanks,
you know,
Steve.
Not on social. It doesn't have to post it. He just lives it. And that's what's really, really cool to watch.
Thanks, Steve. Listen, you guys make it easy to be that person around here, though, because you guys, there's a lot of, you know, there is a lot of kindness and compassion in this building, you know, and it's nice to be around you guys, and also a lot of talent. But, I mean, that always comes back to that thought, you know, you use your talent for your work and you save your real genius for your life. Right? You can, if you lose that balance, you know, between your life and your work, You can get in trouble. I have friends tremendously successful.
I agree.
And have reached all the things they've wanted, but in the process, they've sacrificed. Sure. Maybe a marriage or children or family. And every one of them have regretted that, you mm-hmm. know, and I've had a few people ahead of me that kind of gave me that advice. So that's always been the most important thing to me is family and personal life and not losing myself. I think I probably did that when I was young, at least got it out of my system before. But that's always what I try to do. I try to keep the perspective, right? This is a job.
Yeah,
you
I mean,
commit to it, but you also don't want to lose track of who you are and not pretend to be something you're not.
Right.
I wish I was – I often look. I wonder at people that are so good in crowds and they're good on social media and they have great comments and stuff of that. And just it's not me. I just think about things differently and so I can't pretend to be something that I'm not. I wish I was, but I just can't, you know. I mean, I think it's great for the exchange of information.
Yeah, sure, yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I follow a few people. I just I'm not on it. I mean, like I'm always really interested. One of the I follow like Neil Gaiman and stuff like this, and he says really, really bright things and turns you on to really interesting books and stuff. There's so many positives that come out of it. I think the positives more than outweigh the negatives.
Yeah, depending on the day, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But just this, you guys having this podcast, being able to provide this to people, you know, it's enabled people to do that. It's enabled people that aren't necessarily attached to the business. You no longer have to do that. We were talking earlier, how do you get into the business when we were younger?
Yeah.
It used to be this really – I mean, I remember looking at the Brothers McMullen and sort of going, wow, a guy made his own movie or
El Mariachi.
El Mariachi or whatever, like Rob Rodriguez. And going, that was a revelation.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Now you got these kids are shooting great films on their cameras. That's amazing. So you know, the technology can be amazing if used, like anything, if used for the right purposes, it's fantastic.
You know, that's the thing, because my son says, because he's in a cinematic arts class, and they're watching movies from every decade, and it's awesome. He comes home and talks about it. He's like, I don't know, I think I might want to be a director.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh,
And, you know, I've directed some stuff, and
Steve's like, just don't say actor. Don't say actor.
Don't torture yourself. But director, but then I am thinking, like, well, pick up your iPhone.
Mm.
Start shooting some stuff. Because obviously, you know, when I directed my shorts, it was on film.
Mm.
There was no digital.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how easy is it now compared to what it used to be, obviously? Yeah. But I'm like, dude, you have a whole studio right on your phone.
Yeah, you can shoot
Let's start shooting some stuff.
You can shoot something not like it and then be like, oh, man, that was a waste of all that film. That was expensive. Right? You can just delete it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But the technology, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, being able to do this. I love listening to podcasts. It's definitely helped me grow as a person. It's opened my mind to other opinions.
Yeah.
You know, just having that information so accessible on the phone, it's just been great. But I have one more question to ask him before we have to wrap up.
Well, I
what do you have?
I want to just get some clarification. You're Finn now.
Yeah.
You were Silas.
When you come back next time.
Right. Do you have a more love for, in terms of your General Hospital characters, is there one that you like more than the others?
I think you're contractually bound to say the one you're currently playing. Which I do. I have a lot of fun with – I am having a lot of fun with this character only because it's such a departure from what I did before.
Sure.
And that was kind of conscious when the writers were very kind when it came back this time that we were able to talk about a character a little bit before that.
Right.
And I think at that point it was just – there was no room for being another, you know, low-talking cool guy on the show. And I decided, you know – Let's have a bigger sandbox to play in. And so playing someone that was awkward and strange, and that was fun for me because it's so far out of my comfort zone.
Sure.
But I couldn't walk through anything either. So that's been fun. It's been a challenge.
Yeah.
The Caleb character is probably the most fun to play because, you know, a vampire, there is no fence holding you in.
Right.
You can walk across the couch and they can't tell you,
The
vampire would never do that. You know, it's not like I try to do stuff like that here. Like, yeah, you talk
no,
to them.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
The vampire can do whatever. So it's a lot of fun.
So you got to do that. You got to think.
Look at the room, bro, and you could do it.
It was your play.
Yeah, you could expand anything you wanted
Interesting.
To do. And usually he did. I approached it like he was subversive. Like he was almost like an anarchist, right? He was just going like, I don't care about any of your norms. You know, I love this girl.
Right.
You know, lovely Kelly. And then just everything else was just, you know, like, just raise havoc, you know? So it was good fun.
Oh, gosh, it's great fun.
McBain was probably the character I was most like.
Sure. Was that a conscious choice or did it end up that way?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. And I was fortunate. I did ride-alongs for like 2 weeks before I started playing McBain with a New York City cop.
Oh, my gosh.
Really kind. And so I really got to know these guys.
Yeah.
I ended up writing a graphic novel, Credence, about some of the experiences I learned from them. I had such respect and had such an enjoyment of spending some time with them. And the nice thing is a lot of times some women occasionally walk up to me and she goes, you remind me exactly of my ex-husband. He was a cop.
Oh, wow.
That kind of reserved. He did, you know, McBain did 10 years and never said I love you, which is kind of unusual for a soap opera. Just couldn't break that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the beautiful Renee Goldsberry saying, can you say the words? If you can, I'm walking out the door. And he goes, do you need them that bad? She says, yes. And he lets her walk out the door. You know, he was that. He was that guy. And that was difficult, but I could relate to that. And so that's who I was probably closest to in terms of who I was. But this guy's fun now, you know?
Yeah. So McBain wins.
Yes!
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
McBain was probably the closest.
Well, you know, it's funny. When we're out on the road, when I travel with Steve, there's a lot of, Jasons! And I can only imagine the amount of McBains that you...
I don't know if they were high-pitched, though.
I don't know.
Because he's so reserved. I don't know if they would... try to temper their excitement a little bit and go.
Well, they don't know what to expect in real life. I mean,
it's McBain, dude.
He's a man of mystery, as you say.
It's McBain. McBain. We got to get McBain on the road.
We had a fun thing at one time when it first for McBain. It was a lot of fun
working
with
you. It was great because I mentioned this on the road a lot. Because the PCPD is so freaking pathetic.
They need a cop.
This is a guy that, you know, was a great adversary on the other side of the law because you didn't know if he was going to break the law or not.
Right.
And he was never going to give up. He was relentless. At some point, you kind of had the feeling that he will probably get you.
Yeah.
You know, and that was what was great because, you know, on the show, you know Sonny's not going to get shot. You know, or die. He's been shot 70 times. But you know I'm not probably going to die, hopefully not again. But to be able to play that for Maurice and I, or for me personally, to be able to play that there is an adversary that has power over me, there's nothing more than I want to play that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it just doesn't make it interesting if everyone's just posturing like, I'm the man. No, I'm the man.
Right, right.
I just never found it interesting at all.
Right.
And the fact that there was something about McBain that you're just like, I don't know about this freaking guy, was enough to change our scenes.
Yeah.
You know, that, I had to respect him because I didn't know.
Well, and
you
what's know, cool
God bless
about that,
Chase, Detective Chase, and these little guys running around now. But it's just not, you know, it's like, he's like, freeze! I'm like, come on, dude.
If a character like McBain is up against Sonny and Jason, someone viewing the show might actually, you know, nowadays, it's like, oh, if Sonny and Jason are up against a cop that I don't recognize, who's going to win that, right?
Yeah.
But if it's McBain, there may be, you know, there's more suspense. Because there is that share, that power, right? There's equal power.
Worthy,
worthy adversaries,
right? In graphic novels, the first thing they teach you is your hero is only as good as the villain.
Totally.
Okay, so that was my next question.
Like
when
you watch like Batman and the Joker, and you watch that, like that, especially that Heath Ledger Joker.
Yeah.
And he almost rises above, and you realize that that's what made it so great is that sort of having that great balance between the two.
Yeah.
That's when things work, when you have.
Right.
Yeah.
So you say graphic novel. Mm-hmm. What is that? What is the definition of that for people who don't know, like myself? A graphic novel,
like
Soul Searcher, right?
A Soul Stealer. Yeah. No.
Oh, Soul Stealer.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, yeah. I should have brought one. You know, I think the graphic novel just ends up taking on sort of more mature content. You know, it's kind of a shift from.
So, but it's a you have an illustrator.
I say just because I don't. If someone asks for a book, I just don't want them taking home to their 5-year-olds. Yeah, yeah. You know, because
here's a comic book.
It's not an Archie comic book. You know.
Right. Right. So it is a comic book. Yeah. For adults.
I think it's probably adult content. I mean, there is a format to it. You know, essentially serialized 24 pages, and usually a graphic novel is a collection of 4 to 5 of those graphic novels. So there is an arc every 24 pages usually on it through the book.
And that's tradition in the genre?
Fairly
is that kind of like a novella?
Yeah. It's
in a way, a
little bit like that. Very similar. Yeah. Because it used to be used by comic books on the thing.
Newsstand.
$1 or 80 cents, whatever. 25 cents when I was a kid. I'm really getting back. But then you'd buy and you'd thumb through it, and then you'd wait for the next one. So this, the graphic novel oftentimes is maybe five of those put together. So like 125, 130 pages.
Yeah.
But it still has like an arc that changes every 25
I see,
so
okay.
pages in the book. But you know, it's mostly the content. And sometimes when I say graphic novels, people think that it's it's not that I don't like, I do love superheroes, but I don't write superhero books. And I'm not really interested in writing superhero books,
yeah.
although I've dabbled a couple times and done a couple things. But a lot of people know there's a great source material for a lot of things done in graphic novels, like Road to Perdition, great movie at the time. It was a
yeah.
graphic novel. And From Hell, that Johnny Depp movie about Jack
yeah.
Lewis, and A History of Violence, really good Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
were all
solid,
graphic novels, as well as some other really great stuff, like Preacher.
Yeah. The AMC show, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember the series, but the graphic novel is Garth Ennis and Steve Yeun, fantastic graphic novel.
Yeah.
Sandman, some of these things are really thought-provoking and really intelligent. And sometimes I think about – I remember someone said something about The Sopranos saying, you know, if Shakespeare was writing today, he wouldn't be writing plays. He'd be writing Sopranos. You know, it was kind of a loose thought.
Sure.
And I think a lot of great writers today would be writing graphic novels instead of maybe writing sonnets or things like that. You know, it's
yeah. –
there's some really, really good writers writing graphic novels. And I'm really – I learn a lot reading.
Now, the illustrations in these graphic novels,
mm-hmm.
are those you as well?
No, I'm not that good.
Okay. So what – so
– I work – essentially, I write. It's the only thing I don't want to, and again, I know you guys got time. I don't want to get too far off, but
no, this
essentially,
is fascinating.
Essentially, what I write ends up being an incredibly long love letter to the writer. I mean, to the artist. The writer writes to the artist because
yeah.
most of what I write, no one sees except the artist.
Yeah.
But you sort of write that page. You know, it's a 4-panel page.
Right.
And you have to sort of think in still terms, unlike movies where you talk about, you know. You know, he puts out his cigarette. You can't write he puts out his cigarette.
Because you're watching it.
You're seeing one drawn panel. So the cigarette, you know, the cigarette's just touching his lips. The flame is burning. Second panel, we see the cigarette lying on the ground. Third panel, we see his shoe stomping out the cigarette. Fourth panel, when we look away, there's nothing
wow.
there. It's stuck to the bottom of his shoe. That becomes something that you're going to do later on. So you have to write in very concise forms. But what you would see on the page when you're done for the written by
yeah.
is you would just see the guy saying the one line or
right.
and, you know,
so you but so you have to think about the line but also think about
you see the film yeah you see the,
yeah.
the images coming out, you know, you see like the story in your head.
That's a lot to parse out when you're thinking about the story,
mm-hmm.
right? I guess maybe once you're used to it, you can see it in
so
those frames.
Do you see it first or do you write
yeah,
it first?
I try to see it in my head first and then do it. And then hopefully you get a great artist. I've been fortunate to work with you know, the three terrific artists, Christopher Shai and John Bolton and Steve Perkins. And these guys sometimes take it and they do exactly what you want. And sometimes they get creative and do their own
yeah.
thing. And then it becomes your ocean.
That's pretty cool.
Things together. So it's a really neat process.
And how much
and
of it is...
And invariably, no one's looking over your shoulder. I mean, it's one of the
right.
beautiful things about writing graphic novels is, you know, it's an open canvas.
Yeah.
And, you know, the... You know,
there's
the,
no publisher that's
yeah.
saying, there's no notes, usually?
You might get something, you know,
right.
but for the most part, you have a lot of freedom to create something.
And with you and the artist, is it... Do you pass it along to the artist and then you're hands off, or is it collaborative?
You're off for a bit, and then you deliver some art.
Okay.
And then you start going back, and you may do it. And my thing is, I always like, you know, unlike what we have to do here sometimes, I always like, if you can see it, you don't have to say it. So sometimes you would have written your character. Like, I always hate when you read,
yeah.
meanwhile, back at the ranch. If
oh,
you
yeah,
see
yeah.
the ranch, you don't need to write that,
sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So I try to go back, and if there's anything that I say, oh, what a beautiful image. I'm taken away from it.
Yeah, interesting.
And the Soul Stealer book was kind of interesting because we tried to do a nice merger between words and art. So we took away, like, sort of the word balloons. So the words just sit on the panel. So it's not – to try to get some poetry kind of sitting in the
yeah,
art rather
yeah,
than having
yeah.
these big, bold balloons, you know?
Right. Wow.
Yeah, I looked up – Soul Stealer on Amazon. This thing's like $400, dude.
I think we sold out. Yeah,
I'm like, is this $400, man?
It's cool.
That's a lot of, yeah.
Doing limited edition stuff is really fun. I mean, it's a big coffee
table. Because you do Comic-Con, right?
Do Comic-Con every year, bro. Come
yeah.
on down.
Yeah.
Doing it again this year. But
I know.
Like even the poetry book's only 1,000 copies. It's just kind of nice. And people
yeah.
feel like they're getting a little something that's kind of
yeah.
It's amazing. It's
intimate,
a great
it's special.
Idea. It's a great
yeah.
idea for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just so cool, man.
One more question for me, if that's all right.
Yeah, yeah, go on, dude.
When you have the urge to write, is it I have a story that is in me that I want to get out? I need to write because it is my release of whatever I need to, like, is writing therapeutic? Is it storytelling? Is it, what part of you comes out when you write, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's that part of you deep down that you didn't know existed sometimes. It's,
yeah.
Hopefully you learn in the process, you learn something about yourself, right? So it becomes kind of a bit of a catharsis. How brave am I? How am I willing to bleed on this page to do this? And you also realize after a few pages, I'm not that into it, you know?
That happens too, yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Or I've written whole things I've never shown anybody, 60, 70 pages of things. I just put them in the file cabinet.
Yeah, since you're an avid writer, I was wondering how much actually makes it to light.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because obviously for people who are avid in anything, there's a ton that we don't ever see.
Yeah.
You know, so do you write often?
You know, there's
now?
There's a sort of a little side note. There was this guy, William Coleridge. I think he wrote that poem From Xanadu to Kubla Khan, right? But he was one of the first literary critics. And this is one of the things I learned writing with Peter Straub. He had a quote one time about the difference between a writer and a poet. And he said, a writer puts words in the right order, and a poet puts the right words in the right order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I learned from Peter. He put the right words in the right order. It's something I'm still learning to do. But I always feel if you've written something and you don't have the right words in the right order, you should just file it away for a while, you know,
right.
Until you really feel like you have something of interest to say to people, you know. And I think that's what I always think about. Is this interesting for people? I mean, this is nice for me sometimes doing the poetry book, because whenever I do book signings, I do some signings and stuff like this, and I always get someone comes up and they have some similar experience. I lost somebody too, or I went through this bout of loneliness, or I went through this bout of addiction, and it becomes an opening up, sharing, bringing people together. And that's always fun, kind of like what we get to do here with the show.
Yeah.
Sometimes you bring people together. Sometimes you bring together generations of people.
Yes.
And that, you know, no matter how cynical we get, which we can, obviously, being here in the factory, every so often you have those moments of clarity where you go, okay, I understand the purpose of this. And I think understanding your purpose in life is really what we're all striving to do.
Yeah, I mean, we get that a lot.
Yeah, fortunately, we see that a lot on the road, and we're so grateful. Four generations show up. I mean, you've seen it. You've been on. You've done a lot of appearances, but it's mind blowing how much impact the show has on people's lives.
Mm.
You know, and to be able to go out and do that we're just so grateful to be able to even see people.
But having someone react to something so personal as something you've written, that must feed you in the same vein, but in a slightly different way too. Like, that's pretty unique and special. Yeah,
it is also incredibly humbling, right?
Well, yeah.
But I sort of feel like if I can do it on some small level, that's my giving back to all the people that did it for me, all the writers, you know, Jack Kerouac and Bukowski and Raymond Carver and all these guys that opened my mind to what was possible. And who shared with me and allowed me to share. And so anytime you can do that, it's really important. I think we have a thing. We were very fortunate. We were blessed, and we got an opportunity to do something with our lives that we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
And I think at some point you owe it to somebody to pass that on. And I've been trying to do this. I'm trying to teach and do some things like that. Just you owe that. You owe that to try to pass that on to somebody else so they can then pass it on. That's progress. And that's, I think, what we're looking to do.
Man. That's a great place to...
You can't end it any better than that.
Dude, take your gifts, share them with the world, make it a better place.
Thank you, bro.
That's it.
You too.
Michael, thank you, brother, for your time, man.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me in. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.
How about that low-voiced, handsome fellow we just had on our show?
I'm McBain. I love McBain so much. Dude, he's so awesome. It's like he didn't even really need to be near the microphone.
No.
He was like the furthest away of any guest from the microphone because his voice is just so like, I'm Batman. And it was like, it's just so awesome.
Dude, it was...
I was hypnotized.
I was hypnotized too. So all cards on the table, I edited his portion already and I had to turn him up. I had to turn him up so
high. Oh, really?
Yeah, because he was, he's got that husky sound, and you and me are like, hey,
we're like freaking, we're like a couple terriers on the mic, and he's like this laid back. And so I had to try to balance it because I had to turn him up so high, and then you could hear us in the background because you and I are so damn loud.
I know. It's like we like sucked the helium out of a balloon. We're like, hey, McBain, what's up? He's like, shut up, you little bastards.
Oh, man. It was an adventure.
He's awesome, man. Oh, he's so great. I'm so happy we got to finally sit down with him.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
He's like a, you know, people on TV sometimes have to be personalities, right? Like, or people that are out in the public, like you have to, you know, they're, and, but we're all artists, but he just like, you know, with his writing and his approach to life and I don't know, he's just super, I don't know.
I mean, just imagine though, and you're right, he totally is. And I don't think people know that about him,
yeah.
Which I think is great, you know, because yeah. we got more insight to who Michael is, and hopefully, you know, the listeners did. But it's like, I mean, imagine life without social media. I mean, he's not on.
Dude, you could read a book or something. Imagine the time.
No, you could write a book.
Well, that's what he does. You're right. Imagine what you can do if you don't use social media. You have time.
Wow, we love it too much.
But
though,
that's so. The thing. I know. I love it. I love it too. It's,
dude, what do you mean? We're going on the road. It's amazing.
I know. The connection, you know, I totally understand what he's talking about. And
sure.
I think there's got to be a balance, right?
Right, like, yes, of course.
I totally get the dopamine aspect of it. Like, I know sometimes I watch my likes and retweets, but it's interesting because sometimes we'll just put out information, right? We're
sure.
trying to convey information, and that's a very efficient way of
Absolutely.
Disseminating information. There are times where I'm just trying to be clever and funny, and those times are the ones that I watch the likes and the retweets because I'm like, I need to know. Like, it's
oh, was I funny?
Was I funny? Right. That's the time where that's the waste of time, right?
Sure.
Right? Is watching, right. is looking for validation. That's the waste of time.
Yes.
The disseminating of information is just practical.
Yeah, it's very practical.
So.
And because, you know, with his books and stuff and everything he does, I'm like, Michael, let me help you, man. Let me help you market this. It's great, you know?
Yeah. He's like, no, so. I only made 1,000 of them, so.
Yeah. No, I don't need your help, buddy.
Thanks anyway.
But he was awesome to have.
I'm going to Comic-Con. Where do you go, Steve?
I don't even know if Michael will listen to this, but Michael, thank you for doing the podcast. The fans appreciate it. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you very much.
I mean, I know that's the saying, but ain't it the truth?
Gentleman yeah. And now someone who's not a gentleman or a scholar, Bradford and I
Hi.
Are we're going on the road.
Yeah.
This week, man.
I know. It's like,
dude, I'm so excited.
Dude, day after tomorrow.
I'm so excited.
Like, this is coming out Wednesday. We're like Saturday, we're going to be in San Francisco.
Oh, man. We have talk about a routing nightmare this time.
Oh, my gosh. So San Francisco, there are still tickets available. We moved to a bigger club because there weren't tickets available. So we moved to a bigger club. We made more available. So come hang out with us this Saturday in San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club, right in the city. It's going to be superb. It's going to be awesome.
And then we go to Sacramento, which is sold out.
Sacramento is sold out, but it's still going to be super fun.
And then we make our way to Grand Rapids, which is sold out.
Which is still going to be fun.
And we go to Chicago, which is?
Sold out.
And then we go to Columbus.
Which is?
Not sold out yet.
No, it is.
Is it?
Yeah.
Sold out. Columbus is too?
Yep.
Okay, great.
So the only shows that are, but then we go to Kansas City, which is still available. There's VIP tickets and regular admission tickets in Kansas City. And in Denver, there's both VIP tickets available.
Yeah.
And I don't know, some people, you know, a lot of people ask the difference. And VIP tickets are the best seats for the show. And then we do like a quick hello and a picture with me and Steve after the show. So you get
Correct.
The best seats to enjoy the show, and then you get to say hi to us and take a picture after the show. So that's what VIP yeah. is. General admission is just the show, which is enjoyable too.
Yeah.
So
and you'll definitely laugh and have fun.
Yes. So that's the difference. If you've had that question, all tickets are available at stonecoldandthejackal.com. You click on tour dates and appearances, and that's where you get those tickets. And so we can't wait. We can't flippin' wait.
What's cool is. And I'm sure people are so tired of us talking about being on the road. But the cool thing is we're going to a bunch of new places.
Ain't that the truth?
You know what I mean? So we're going to San Fran, which we haven't done, Grand Rapids, Michigan, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Denver, and Columbus.
Right, all new cities for us.
All new cities. We've been to Chicago, which we love, obviously, and then we've been to Sacramento, which is your hometown, which we've been there once. This is the second time. This will be the second time, yeah.
But now we get it. Everybody comes here now because we like it so much.
Yeah, everybody. Maurice came up. Everybody's coming up. So this is our home.
Damn it.
Everybody get out.
Yeah, right.
This is Bradford's house. So we're looking forward to seeing you guys this week. We can't wait. We got a bunch of new stuff and fun stuff. And everybody's asks about kind of what the show is. And, you know, we just have fun. We have stories. We have laughs about General Hospital. New stories all the time. Bradford sings some very funny songs. New songs in places we've been before. So we're just going to have a ball, dude.
Yeah,
and we're spend a lot of time in the car together.
It's true. I hopefully get a big enough one.
Yeah, you better get a freaking minivan, dude.
I don't know if it's going to be a minivan this time, dude.
Oh, don't do it, dude. I'll like sit down and take a nap. I don't care.
But thank you all. Thanks again to Michael, and we'll be seeing some of you next week. And otherwise, we'll be talking to you wicked soon.
And check out Michael's book on Amazon.com.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a TrueCar cash offer.
Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions, get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride.
So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
If you like our show, you're going to love Showmance with Kevin McHale and Jenna Ushkowitz on Podcast One. Join the former Glee stars and best friends as they interview other dynamic duos about the wild ups and downs of balancing a relationship on set. Download new episodes of Showmance with Kevin McHale and Jenna Ushkowitz every week on Podcast One.